This is All Things Considered on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare. This week it was announced that Senate Majority Leader Chip Rogers, who is leaving that position, will also leave his state Senate seat and take a position at Georgia Public Broadcasting, which is not affiliated with WABE, we should point out right away. Georgia Public Broadcasting, where he will be involved in projects to help with job creation and development and links between the business community and education. Chip Rogers joins us in his office at the Capitol. Senator Rogers, welcome. Good to have you.
Dennis, always good to be with you. And, you know, my days in broadcasting, it's been a few years, and we used to have these giant recorders that weighed 20 pounds. I know you're familiar with them, and this looks a lot nicer.
You just ran for a state Senate seat. You went through a very difficult primary. You asked the voters to say, hey, put me back in that seat. Why go ahead now and say, okay, I'm going to take this job?
Well, first of all, it's an incredible opportunity. Sometimes you recognize that you can be more effective in other roles. And I now see this role that's been presented to me as one that really talks about the things that I'm so interested in. I mean, really gets down to the core of my interests. Growing Georgia's economy, the state up, matching that with education, which has really kind of been my hallmark the last few years in my legislative life, being able to bring those together is something that it's almost like a dream come true. So this is just a great opportunity. But beyond that, being able to kind of refocus my life with respect to my job and family is something that has just really been placed on my heart in recent months. And that's just something that, you know, once it's there, you can't deny.
But after asking the voters for their vote, what do you say to them when you say so soon after the election, okay, I'm going to leave and you're going to be voting for somebody else now?
Well, you know, that sometimes politicians get into positions and they tend to believe that their seats are their seats. That seat doesn't belong to me. It belongs to the 180,000 people in North Fulton and East Cherokee. The timing is one that, you know, as a believer, sometimes the Lord places things on your heart and you can't deny or try to change those things. They are what they are. And again, this position is not mine. I've done everything in my power to fill this position the best I could and serve my constituents over the last 10 years. But there's a lot of other people out there that can do a great job as well.
In your statement when you decided not to seek re-election as majority leader, you listed a number of accomplishments that you said had happened either with your help or under your guidance. Most conspicuously absent from that, as I noticed, was the immigration law that passed a few years ago. You were closely identified with that. Was that just something when you made the list that you chose to leave off, or was that just something that didn't make it?
I think I left it off by accident. Honestly, that list was compiled rather quickly. Look, we took a path no one else had taken at that time. We were the first state in America to have a comprehensive across-the-board immigration enforcement law, and I was able to bring together all of the entities that were involved in this. We worked very closely with Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, worked very closely, if you recall, with Senator Sam Zamarripa. Prior to that time, if you go back and look in 2003, 2004, 2005, you had all sorts of individual pieces of legislation aimed at trying to correct this problem. I finally took the bull by the horns and said, look, you can't solve this simply through an enforcement measure here. You can't simply solve it through the criminal justice system. You have to kind of look at it from a global perspective. And that was what we did. And we started with a blank sheet of paper and ended up with a law that even most of the critics said, while it wasn't perfect, they clearly were brought in the process and understood it. So I was very proud that we worked across the aisles. Worked with all of those, everybody that was involved or was going to be impacted by that. We worked with them, and a lot of the anger and hatred that was directed towards me, threats, the fact that I went for a three-week period of time where I had to have police protection every day on me and my family, those are not things that any public official ever wants to have happen. And so I don't really talk about it a lot anymore. And maybe that was psychologically one of the reasons in the back of my head I didn't put it on that list.
Do you think that the subsequent legislation, which you did not sponsor, you were not one of the authors of it,
right.
HB 87, which is now under court challenge, do you think that at least parts of that went too far in creating a perception among Latinos and perhaps among employers and professionals who are trying to get licenses that the government is just making it too difficult and too punitive?
Well, I'm not going to pass judgment on the work done by others in that respect. Would I have crafted the bill a little bit differently? Probably so. But you have to remember, in that interim between when I began working on this in 2005 and when it was worked on again in 2010, 2011, things had changed dramatically. While I had the ability to literally sit down with the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, when it was addressed again in 2011, they didn't have that opportunity. The well had been poisoned, so to speak, and sides had been drawn. And so I don't think that Representative Ramsey and others had the ability or were given the opportunity to really sit down at that level and work with the other side as I would, or as I had the opportunity back in 05 and 06. So it was just a totally different environment. So I'm not going to cast any aspersions on what was accomplished. Again, would I have drawn it up a little differently? Maybe. But I know Representative Ramsey is a good man, and he tried to do the very best job he could. And I have had conversations with him where I know his feelings towards working on that issue going forward are the same that I had back in 2006. And that was, you know, you take that issue on. It's very, very difficult. And then you're really ready and willing and able to hand it off to somebody else.
Among the things that you mentioned on your list of accomplishments was particularly tax reform, property tax reform, and so forth. The state revenues have not kept pace with, lately anyway, with what the expectations were that they would be. And the state now faces, once again, a debate over a very large shortfall in the budget. Was that the right time to put in the kind of thing that would take revenue from the state without saying, okay, what do we do here? Do we have ending of other tax breaks? Do we have further spending cuts? Was the timing the best it could have been on the measure that you pushed?
Well, there's two measures. First was the elimination of the state portion of the property tax, which was only a quarter mil, and it was about $90 million. So in the global scheme of the state budget, which is $19 to $20 billion, that was very little. I think it was important, though, number one, to eliminate a tax. Number two, that the state get out of the business of property taxes, because the state really has no role in property taxes. That is clearly a local tax. But the more important thing that I think has had a far greater impact is when we passed property tax reform in general. And that is one that has never gotten a lot of media coverage, but I can promise you, for the millions of Georgians who now have a fair shake at the property tax system with respect to appealing and processing that appeal, to the hundreds of thousands of Georgians who have received what amounts to a property tax cut in that their assessments are now done accurately as they should have always been done. That legislation will go down, when I look back at my career in public service, as one of the things I'm most proud of, because we really cleaned up a system that desperately needed some cleaning up and still does to this day.
Was that an unfair burden then for the local governments who depend so heavily on that?
No, absolutely not. The unfair burden was a tax system that was really ripping off Georgia taxpayers. When you had people that were purchasing a house 1 year for $200,000 and getting a tax assessment 6 months later for $400,000, my concern is for those people, not the government who's going to ultimately receive the money. So, you know, the local governments can take care of themselves. They have the ability to vote to raise or lower the millage rate. The property taxpayer has an expectation that the assessment of their property needs to be accurate, in line with fair market value. That law change a few years ago makes that happen. And for that, all people in Georgia, all property owners, even if you don't own property, if you're renting, you ought to be happy with that, because that side of the equation needs to be fair. And then let the elected officials make a case as to why the tax rate should go up or down.
The last year has been politically not the easiest for you. There was the talk about the Agenda 21 meeting where people looked at a video about an alleged conspiracy by President Obama to bring the nation under a UN kind of control. What would you say to people who wonder particularly about the Agenda 21 video? Do you really think that President Obama is behind a mind control effort to bring people under a socialistic one world regime?
There's been a lot of crazy stories. The last one that you referenced rates as the craziest. You know, we had some constituents who had given speeches and talks and I guess learning sessions on Agenda 21, which is a UN resolution. I mean, there's no one debating that it exists or not.
No, it's the characterization of what it is that everybody right. fights about.
But I had a group of constituents who had given that class, so to speak, in this capital a number of times. And they simply called me and said, hey, can you help reserve a room for us so we can invite some people to come see it, which is exactly what we did. And I would have done for any constituent group that wanted to do that. That was one of the more silly news. I guess there was just a dry time in the news cycle. maybe that's why people jumped on that one.
But you did sponsor an amendment, did you not, back in 2011 that said, no, the state shouldn't pass any laws that would bring us in any way under Agenda 21.
A resolution, yeah. A number of states across the country have done that. And, I mean, when you look at the heart of some of the things even with my work on property taxes, I have, from day one, perhaps been the greatest property rights advocate in this building. And any effort to diminish people's private property rights is something I'm, for the rest of my life, going to fight against. Because I think it's, if you don't have the right to own property, it really, it breaks down the entire underpinning of a free market society.
Do you really think, though, that President Obama is subscribing to some sort of long-range plan that would, in the view of some folks, like force suburbanites into cities, that kind of thing? Do you really think that President Obama is part of that?
I can't imagine that the president, with all the things he has to worry about, has gotten into local land planning. Maybe that's something he'll get into after his career is over. I don't even want to get into local land planning. I do want to help people, you know, maintain their private property. But I, you know, I feel for my county commissioners and people in city councils that have to deal with that. It's a very tedious issue. So, no, I do not think the president is worried about those type of things.
During your time as majority leader, there was a battle with Lieutenant Governor Cagle over who would control what powers in the Senate. There was concern across the Capitol from Speaker Ralston, who said it publicly many times, we just don't even know who's in charge over there. Looking back on it, was that handled the way you think it, the best way it could have been? And did that diminish the effectiveness of the Senate because of the internal questions both in the Senate and on the other side of the Capitol in the House?
I would say that everybody that was involved or has been involved in that process would probably take some credit or share in some blame at the friction that was caused by that. No one did it exactly right. So you certainly go back and look at it and say, how would I change things? And you might do something a little bit different. With respect to the Senate, I would disagree with that assertion, not that you're making it, that others have made, that it in some way diminished the ability of the Senate to get the job done. I mean, if you look at what we were able to accomplish the last few years, I would put up our record of success against any other Senate at any other time. You know, you look back at just some of the big things, for example, the Hope Scholarship a couple of years ago, the Charter Amendment, which required us to get Democrat votes. We were able to deliver those things. The tax reform, it passed the Senate unanimously. So I think the record shows that the Senate did exceptionally well the last 2 years, and I hope it continues regardless of how the rules shake out this time. But, you know, we all have concerns, I guess, about maybe how some of the things happened on an interpersonal level. You have colleagues that you're not as close to anymore because of these type of political frictions. And, you know, I think all of us need to look inside sometimes and say, is the political battles that we fight each other on worth the personal friendships that we lose over them? And I've just come to the conclusion that they're not. I mean, I have great regrets over some of the friendships that I've lost because of this. And recognizing that, you know, seeking power, whether it's for the body or for anybody else, needs to be tempered with how you want to have your interpersonal relationships for the foreseeable future. And so, again, my only regret is that this process has yielded that. But I'm still young, got a lot of time to make those back up.
So would you seek elective office again?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe someday. The most important office I have right now is dad. You know, when I got elected, I had a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old. I now have a 13-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 9-year-old, and a 7-year-old. So my most important job over the next few years is to make sure that that relationship with my children is something that will benefit them for the rest of their lives, because I know it's going to benefit me.
because a cynic who does political math might say, okay, he is taking this new job as something that will solve a lot of problems, both for him, for the lieutenant governor with whom you had some political battles, for the governor, for everyone. Is this that kind of a move?
No. In fact, I can tell you the governor has been amazingly supportive. The only math I've been looking at is how many more days I get to spend at home.
So this was not a way of solving a lot of problems?
It solves some problems for me personally, and that I the challenges that I face. But no, had I decided to stay here in this position, I think things would have gone on perfectly fine as they have the last few years.